I think we'll go ahead and begin. I want to give our speaker as much time as possible tonight. Thank you to all of you brave souls who came out in spite of what the weathermen were telling us. I think we're all safe. In fact, you really couldn't be in a safer space than this auditorium, so you came to the right place. Before we kind of officially start, I think I will just remind everybody, if you have a cell phone, would you please turn it off at this time? I'll give you a few minutes. That's always good for the speaker to turn his cell phone off. Okay, I'd like to begin by wishing you a good evening. I'm Terry Thornton, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I think, as many of you know, this is the first of a series that will run until the end of March. We appreciate very much Art Lies being here tonight. Art Lies being a quarterly publication, and they're here in promotion of this program in particular, and also to just let people know more about the publication. I hope you were able to see some of the materials they had on the table out in the lobby before you came in, and if you did miss that, never fear, they will be back every week through February. So for each lecture, you can come in and ask questions if you have them, or better yet, go ahead and sign up for a subscription. And I wanted to bring to your attention, which was, I'm just going to go ahead and confess, was just brought to my attention, or I would have had it fully read and made more of it. Our good friend and very good artist and writer, Noah Symblist, actually wrote a piece on page 103 in this current issue of Art Lies on tonight's speaker, Waleed Rod. So take heed. All right. Tuesday Evenings, for those of you who are new to the program, is a fall and spring lecture series, and we're quite proud to offer it for free to our public, with the galleries remaining open until 7 p.m. through the run of the series. And next week, Jeff Elrod, artist Jeff Elrod, will be here to talk about his work as found in the Modern's second focus exhibition for this year. And that exhibition opens this weekend. So I'm telling you all of this to advise you to come a little early next week so that you do have time to go through the galleries, spend some time with the work, and then come in and hear what Jeff has to share with us. In addition to having access to the galleries throughout the series, the cafe keeps their coffee bar open on these Tuesdays until the lectures begin at 7 p.m. as well. But for a little forewarning for you creatures of habit who are faithfully here every week, next week the cafe is going through some reconstruction. I think they're changing out the carpet or something. Anyway, it will be closed, but we've made accommodations, and there will be a cash bar in the lobby. So don't be thrown when you walk in the front door and everything doesn't look as usual. You can get drinks there, and then, as I said, Art Lies will also be set up. So all the more reason to come early next week. I mention all of this, but of course, these are simply perks to an outstanding program whose reputation is, in fact, built on the extraordinary caliber of the guest speakers who have agreed to participate over the past 15-plus years that this lecture series has been running. Tonight is, of course, no exception. We are both grateful and honored to have the artist, Waleed Rod, here to share information and archival materials pertaining to the Atlas Group, a group that Waleed founded in 1999 as a means to research, document, consider, and portray contemporary Lebanese history. Having received an MA and a PhD in Cultural and Visual Studies at the University of Rochester, Waleed is Associate Professor of art at the Cooper Union in New York, as well as recognized artists represented by the Paula Cooper Gallery in New York, Anthony Reynolds Gallery in London, and the Sverre Selmer Gallery in Hamburg, Germany. Waleed's practice as an artist is varied, including video, photography, mixed media installation, performance, and literary essays, but generally seems to be concerned with contemporary conditions and circumstances of his native Lebanon. It is a complex and dense subject that, through the sincerity and brilliance of this work, offers timeless and universal lessons. Lessons we stand to learn in tonight's presentation, The Loudest Muttering is Over, documents from the Atlas Group Archive. Please join me in welcoming Waleed Rod.
I would like to thank you, Terry, for this introduction and this invitation, and I would like to thank Noah from SMU for this invitation as well, and I will thank you all for being here tonight. I hope you can hear me well in the back. Yes? Okay. I'm going to be reading a little bit from a prepared text because it's easier for me, and then I will also talk informally and show you some images and videotapes. But usually, when I talk about the Atlas Group as an art project I have undertaken for the past 10 or 15 years, the project has taken three different forms. It has taken a performance form, it has taken an exhibition form, and it has taken a publication form. Usually, when I do the performance form, it looks very much like an artist talk. I will request a podium. I will request a bottle of flat water. I will have a projector, lights falling on me as they are now. Inevitably, like in all artist presentations, there will be some kind of technical difficulty during the talk. The talk ends. There's a question and answer session. And usually, I would have some help from actors that are in the audience to ask me some questions of things that I thought needed to come up. And then as these artist talks usually go, there's an end, an informal discussion with a group of people who may or may not be interested in what I presented. And then I'm invited to dinner by the people who invited me, where the conversation continues. And then maybe with a few folks, you might go and get a drinks and then back to the hotel. This entire scenario was for me the object of a performance that I would normally use to talk about the Atlas Group. But today I'm not going to do this, and you just have to believe me that it's the case. I'm just going to try to reflect a bit on the project, because the more I think about this project, the more it has been difficult for me to find today anything productive to say about it. And I'm not sure why this has been the case. It's been increasingly more difficult to think about the possibilities of the project. I can only today think of its limits. I can only think of the assumptions that informed it, whether they were formal assumptions, philosophical assumptions, historical assumptions, that I just feel are in need of serious rethinking. And I haven't yet been able to find, to figure out whether the problem I have with something I've spent so much time on was with the documents, the artworks themselves that I have produced, or whether it's with the language I have used to talk publicly, but also to myself about what I'm involved in. But one thing that has happened to me that's interesting, and I'm sure it has happened to many artists, writers, and thinkers, and others here, is that sometimes you just stumble on a writer, you come across a collaborator in a timely or an untimely way, and they all of a sudden provide you with insight and the language that speaks the complexity of things you thought did not have words, things that you might have felt but lacked the appropriate language to speak about these things. And for me, this writer is somebody I've known for 12 years, but only recently came to find an affinity with his concepts. And his name is Jalal Tufik. He's originally from Iraq. today teaches in Turkey, was trained in the United States, has written about 8 books in English. The first book was the result of his dissertation work, which was on vampires, an uneasy essay on the undead in film. His second book was a book of aphorisms called Distracted in its second edition. And the third book was titled Oversensitivity and introduced a notion that became increasingly more interesting to me, a notion called the withdrawal of tradition past a surpassing disaster. And this is something that I think tomorrow at SMU we will spend maybe some time discussing further. But this fortuitous encounter with this writer has been very productive for me, so much so that I have a hard time today thinking a thought, having an idea without going through his writings. And it's a bit embarrassing because I've become almost an uncritical fan of this person's work. But it has been very productive and I think is informing new artworks. But if I... Maybe I can suspend a bit of these questions I have about the Atlas Group, because I assume most of you have not seen the projects, you have not been initiated to the documents. So I thought maybe I would present the actual project, and maybe in the question and answer period we'll have time to talk about the difficulties, or maybe they're not difficulties. Okay. I will give you a bit of biographical background. I grew up in Lebanon. I grew up during the years of the Lebanese hot wars, which are ongoing, it seems, maybe. But I left Lebanon in 1984 to come to the United States, and stayed in the United States, was trained in the United States in photography initially and then in visual and cultural studies. And in the early 90s, Lebanon, there was some kind of officially sanctioned end to the hot wars, and there was a process of rebuilding the country. And during that time, in 1991, 92, I returned for the longest period I had spent in Lebanon since leaving in 84. I spent a year working with a Canadian-Lebanese artist on the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon. And we worked on a videotape about the detention of people who were, the detention of Lebanese and Palestinians who were resisting this occupation, had been detained in this detention center called Khiyam, which was in Israel's self-proclaimed security zone. And these are people who had been released and were talking about what they had experienced. So I spent a year working on this, but it had been, I had left as a teenager and I've come back as a 22-year-old. And for one reason or another, during this year-long stay, I decided to read Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, A la recherche du temps perdu. And I was living in the house that, in my father's house in Lebanon. I was doing all this work on South Lebanon, people who had been involved in, had been tortured in these detention centers in the South and wanted to speak about their experiences. I was witnessing the country trying to proclaim an end to the civil war and initiate a process of rebuilding through a massive reconstruction of downtown Beirut. And at the same time, I was reading Proust and the famous Madeleine episode of dipping the little cake in the tea and then bringing it up to his nose. And all of a sudden, the narrator of the book realizes that he's flooded by memories that he thought he had forgotten. And he cannot understand how is it that some things are available to conscious recollection and some things are available through this accidental encounter with an object. And can this object that brings back the full content of the me, can it be willed? Can I choose the object, or is it always going to be a matter of chance whether I encounter it? And if I encounter it and others don't, is this just their fate? But this structure of memory, this idea that that the nature of memory was not necessarily cognitive but could be historical, was something I took very seriously and tried to track through the readings of Proust, through some readings on Baudelaire, through some readings on Freud, following mainly an essay by Walter Benjamin called On Some Motifs in Baudelaire. It's a dense essay. I never understood what it meant, so I thought maybe I should read the books that he had read, and I read Freud, Proust, and Poe to try to make sense of that book. And it helped a bit. But during that year when I was there, one of the things I did a lot is I collected a lot of photographs. And photographs that eventually formed the Atlas Group archive. These are photographs that I collected between 1991 and 1994 and 95. And I spent the next 10 years giving them some kind of form and shape. Eventually, at some point, I realized that I was creating, not only was I collecting photographs that I found in Lebanon's audiovisual culture, but I was also, I needed to create the universe in which these documents existed that I found. I needed to create some kind of structure, some kind of subject position that permitted these documents to speak, some kind of a universe with laws in it that would somehow not collapse too fast. And I found myself creating notebooks. I found myself creating videotapes and photographs. And over time, by the late 90s, I realized that I had amassed different kinds of objects. I had notebooks, I had films, I had photographs, I had videotapes, and I had attributed, in my mind, each document to a particular character. And this was done somewhat consciously, but somewhat intuitively. And then I started looking at what I had and decided to organize it, and to start describing a bit what I had done. And the public presentation of the material is called "The Loudest Muttering is Over, Documents from the Atlas Group Archive." And the first step of the presentation is usually just to talk maybe about the structure that I end up giving the documents that I found. I ended up calling my archive the Atlas Group Archive, founded in 1999. And I realized at some point that I had three kinds of documents that I had produced. There were documents that needed to be organized under some kind of category that I called Type A. And these were, this stood for documents that I had created, but that I attributed to individuals that I had named. Other documents remained for me anonymous. I produced these documents, but I chose to attribute them to anonymous institutions or individuals. And then a third type of documents I call Type AGP, which stood for the Atlas Group Productions. And maybe the fantasy at the time was the Atlas Group could become some kind of aesthetic, political, economic, psychic think tank. Wouldn't it be great if I could just get a number of people or collaborate with a number of individuals and start creating, discussing about the possibilities and limits of writing this history of the wars of the past 30 years in the midst of this rebuilding frenzy that was insisting on putting the war behind it and not think about it. So the AGP became Atlas Group Productions, and then I started filling these categories. So under the Type A, I realized that I had a historian, a man named Fadl Fakhouri. I had an individual named Suhail Bashar, and I had an operator named Operator Number 17. And then every individual had a number of documents. For example, the historian, I attributed to the historian notebooks, films, and photographs. And in this case, I would say publicly that this historian produced and donated to the Atlas Group around 200 plus notebooks. But of the 200 plus notebooks, we only make a certain number available. And they are Notebook Volume 38, Notebook Volume 57, and Notebook Volume 72. And then, eventually, if I filled the archive, by 2004, it looked like this. And I would see to it that the documents became public through lectures, exhibitions, and publications. And I always like to begin with this historian, Fadl Fakhouri. Publicly, I would introduce him as one of the most important historians of Lebanon, and that at the time of his death, to many people's surprise, this historian donated to the Atlas Group a number of documents. They included films, videotapes, and notebooks. Now, the notebooks in question are all very similar in structure. I would say that every notebook had a title and a number. Every notebook had a foreword or an appendix, and every notebook would tell a story. a story about some event, some situation, some character linked in a very tangential way to the actual history of the war. What I was not interested in is reducing the war to a series of chronologies, to a chronology of massacres, or to the psychobiography of its participants. I was not interested in doing that kind of work. I felt it was being done, and it seemed to me that there was other kinds of documents that needed that I needed to pay attention to. So I will show you the first kind of document. The first notebook I usually begin with is titled Notebook Volume 72, Missing Lebanese Wars. This is the notebook's cover, numbered and titled. This is the appendix, in this case written in French, and every notebook would tell a story. And here it's a particular story about historians who used to bet on horse races. So the story goes that it's a little known fact that the major historians of the Lebanese Wars were compulsive gamblers. It is said that they met every Sunday at the horse racetrack. The Marxists and the Islamists would bet on races 1 through 7. The Maronite nationalists and the socialists would bet on races 8 through 15. Race after race, the historians stood behind the track photographer, whose job was to image the winning horse as it crossed the finish line, the person who's responsible to record the photo finish. Now, it is said that the historians convinced, some say bribed, the photographer to snap only one picture as the winning horse arrived. And the historians wagered on precisely when, how many fractions of a second before or after the horse crossed the finish line, the photographer would expose his frame. Now, this may seem a bit abstract, so this is a typical notebook plate. So every notebook plate, these photographs that are on the bottom right are actually published every Monday. They're historical artifacts. They're published every Monday in Lebanese newspapers. If you're a fan of horse race gambling and you weren't able to attend the race, you could always consult Monday's paper and you would find these photographs. Throughout the early 90s, I collected these photographs and I was always baffled by the inability of the photographer to catch the horse at the finish line. The horse was always too early or too late, it was always blurry, and I couldn't figure out, but I was fascinated by the fact that the photographer did not care. Nor did the viewers insist that the photograph must show the horse at the finish line. And eventually, it became one part of this document that included this photograph. And then it would include some notations on the race distance, the winning time of the winning horse, the average speed of the winning horse. My 7 or 8 historians with their respective bets. For example, historian K.S., was betting that in the photograph, the horse is represented 71 centimeters before the finish line. Then the winning historian's bet and his or her initials. I would calculate the actual distance between the horse's head and the finish line. And then you can see on top of a paragraph in English that publicly I would say it puzzled us, and we inquired with the historian's wife, who told us that her husband had an odd habit of describing the winning historian in his notebook. And in this case, the winning historian was described as, he is not merely miserable, but is brilliant at it. There seems no event, no matter how trivial, that does not arouse him to a frenzy of self-mortification. I ended up producing 11 such notebook plates. Here, the winning historian is described as uncivil and sullenly rude, haughty and arrogant. Here, water slid on his face, and he was always afraid that his face will follow. He was a man who presented himself as God-fearing, strict in his personal habits, a teetotaler, and a vegetarian. Vicious, mindless, and totalitarian. He always pointed the finger at assorted rogues, morons, and neo-colonialists, and an imagined conspiracy of Jewish currency traders who he says are bent on keeping his country poor and servile. He is 71, but for 6 years he was in prison, and for 10 years he was under house arrest and in exile, so those 16 years should be deducted. Then he is 55. What mattered to her most of all was to avoid anything that might be reminiscent of empathy. Now, what fascinated me in a way, and I didn't realize this for a bit, why did it matter to me that this horse was earlier or too late? And I came across an interesting proposition. There's this idea, I think, that came to me maybe from the Proust and the Benjamin, that there has to be a distinction maintained between the lived and the experienced, particularly when one is dealing with events of extreme violence, and that some of these events that may have been lived may not have been experienced yet. They haven't found the language that exhausts their meanings, that permits the affect attached with these very loaded violent events to kind of dissipate, to find an outlet. So when I kept thinking about this horse races, I was thinking about this idea of being too early or too late, a structure that will come back throughout the Atlas Group project. But this idea of the inability to be present to the passage of the present, this inability to be on time, this inability to be present to the passage of the horse, to capture it on time, opened up for me the question of how to write the history in particular of the Lebanese events of the past 30 years. If I proceeded from the assumption that these events were of a particular violent nature, that one could call them traumatic, what made them traumatic was not necessarily the number of people they killed, was not necessarily the kind of economic and material damage it had done, but what made them traumatic was the way they were experienced after the fact. The way, in some cases, they produced hysterical symptoms in culture, hysterical symptoms that it was my task then to collect. Hysterical, historical documents that I could find in Lebanon's audiovisual culture, gather, study, produce the universe that permitted these documents to speak, and then archive. Now, as you can see, the major notion informing this is pretty much a psychological or psychoanalytic notion of trauma. And this is precisely what became for me the limit 10 years later. Today, I find this approach a bit in need of revision, that there might be some events that are violent events, but they affect more than the subject who experiences them. They may affect the world itself. So that, let's say in the psychoanalytic model or in the psychological model, I could look at these photographs and say the horse is too early or too late as a metaphor for the way one experiences events of extreme violence in their hysterical manifestation, too early, too late. In another way, in the way I'm thinking today, I'm trying to think, is it possible that a horse could freeze, literally, in the world? So it's not the photographer who's unable to catch the horse on time. It's literally the horse that is freezing, and the photographer is just capturing the freezing of the horse. Now, why would a horse freeze before or after the finish line is another consideration. But I'm becoming more open to this idea that certain things, particularly events of extreme violence, may not and should not only be viewed through a psychological model of trauma, that there might be another way to think about them. And I'm not sure if some of the documents I had been producing all along were dealing with that or not. I'll continue. And the last document from this series was called, the historian has described as a potent shadow and a legend that has grown into an officially sanctioned cult. At some point, I found it that I needed to give this historian a body, and I produced a work called Civilizationally, We Do Not Dig Holes to Bury Ourselves. And I would say that the only photographs we have of the historian were found in this small brown envelope titled on its back, Civilizationally, We Do Not Dig Holes to Bury Ourselves. And inside were 12 small black and white photographs, self-portraits produced by the historian himself in 1958 and 1959 during his one and only trip outside of Lebanon to Paris and Rome. Now, I've told two stories about these documents, that this is an actor and this is an elaborate kind of setup, and I'm hired somebody who is very good in Photoshop. or that these are actually photographs that my father had produced in 58 and 59. What's fascinating here is I really like the one on the left. You know, the person stands in front of these major monuments and always decides to look somewhere else. You know, under the Eiffel Tower, and he's going to look at, I don't know, somebody passing by somewhere else. And he begins outside with major monuments. Some of them are typical touristic shots, just standing in front of the monument, and some of them are looking somewhere else. And then he starts to encounter people in the kind of a day-to-day life. He kind of disappears a bit in the background, like with the lawnmower here. He's just folding, you know, he's disappearing somewhat with the crowd in the back. And then he retreats to his room, to his hotel, where he's just, he ends up in bed, I think, just reading a book. But this is a series of 24 images, and I'm just showing you 10. Another one of his notebooks, another one of his films, are called No Illness Is Neither Here Nor There. I'm going to skip this for the sake of time because I think I'm going a bit slow. I'm not going to talk about them. I'll show you another one of his notebooks called Let's Be Honest, The Weather Helped. I guess that would apply today. This is actually my bullet collection when I was growing up. And I used to collect them by their size and by the colors on the tips. And I was really hoping to gather every kind of hue I could find. And the way it worked, I collected bullets and shrapnel, and many people around me did this. So after a night of shelling or bombing, the first thing you would do is just go outside and find these things wherever you could. Some of the bullets I would trade with friends or would buy from a militiaman or would get from a friend or from somebody who had that kind of weapon. The tips are quite, they have these beautiful hues. Sometimes what I would do is I would also take a photograph. I did this when I was very young. I hadn't seen this collection till maybe I was in my 20s. I had collected them when I was maybe between 8 and 14, 15. And by the time I came back in the early 90s, I saw that I had this bullet collection. And I was a bit surprised that I had it. Sometimes I would photograph where I found the shrapnel or I found the bullet itself. So at some point I decided that I should create a notebook for my historian. What I didn't know, and this came almost 20 years, this came to me only in the past 5 years, when I started doing research on the manufacturing of ammunition. And to my surprise, I found out that every manufacturing country devises a distinct color code for their bullets. So that the British have a distinct color code, the Americans have a distinct color code, Brussels has its own color code, the NATO countries, the Soviet Union had a color code. So that if I went back to my bullet collection and read the color codes through that kind of prism, I had collected bullets from every country that had produced and sold weapons for the Lebanese militias in the past 30 years. So I had what I thought was a purely kind of aesthetic activity was almost a political economy of the war in and of itself, and I had no clue. So I started thinking, okay, wouldn't it be great to do a document dedicated to each country that had funded a militia? So let's pretend this is the Saudi color code. I'm going to give them a whole page in a notebook. So these are bullets supposedly found on this building that all were manufactured by Saudi Arabia. Namely, the bullets had on their tips a green, orange, purple, and were of different diameters. This is the People's Republic of China. And behind each one of those is an actual bullet hole that I decided to cover with the appropriate diameter and color and attributed to my historian. This is the United States color code. This is the color code of Switzerland. the NATO countries? The United Kingdom? And Israel's color code. I made 17 plates from this notebook, and those were the 17 different countries that I had in my personal collection. Okay, another notebook, notebook volume 38. Titled, numbered, appendix in Arabic, it states, this notebook contains 145 cutout photographs of cars. They correspond to the exact make, model of number, make, model, and color of every car that was used as a car bomb in the wars of 75 to 91. When I did this in the early 90s, I had severely undercounted the number of cars. I subsequently did a survey, and there were 3,641 car bombs in the 17-year Civil War. That was almost one per day for 17 years, not unlike what we witnessed in Iraq in the past few years. But when I started this research for a very banal reason. I couldn't understand why in Lebanon in the 1980s and 90s you could buy the latest model Benz or BMW for a fraction of the cost it would cost elsewhere. You could buy the latest model Benz for $2,000-$3,000 in Beirut. And that was mostly because many of these cars had been smuggled into the country by militias through the illegal ports they ran. And some of these cars had actually been stolen or had a strange kind of record behind them. So they were smuggled through the ports, ended up in the city where they essentially funded the militias who were running the wars. When I was starting to, one of the things that also captured me is a particular brand of Benz, a white Benz, a 220 Benz built in the 70s that every time I saw when I would walk in Beirut, for some reason, and I didn't understand why, I found myself propelled, if it was on this side of the sidewalk, I would immediately go to the other side of the sidewalk. And I would seek some glass-free facade. And I had no clue why. But I noticed that I was doing it. Every time there's a Benz, I would go to the other side. So I started going into the archive and looking at, just researching car bombs. I was researching car bombs because they had been used also, the white Benz had been used heavily by Hezbollah in the films they made to celebrate the martyrdom of their own militants against the Israeli occupation. Whenever Hezbollah or any of the resistant groups would make a videotape to celebrate somebody, a recreation of a martyrdom operation, sometimes they would show that figure driving a white Benz. And in the accounts of Israeli soldiers who were describing how they prepared for the war in the south, for the resistance, they said, if we saw a white Benz, we would certainly be ready. And I couldn't tell if this was what informed this. Is this caricature? Is this just something you hold on to? So I ended up going to the archive to research whether the white Benz had any weight. And then I was researching car bomb after car bomb, and it turned out that the only thing the newspapers made available during that period about car bombs was not so much who planted the car and why, but we got to know a lot about what make, model, and color that car was. We got to know a lot about the kinds of explosives that were used, the perimeter of destruction. So I decided to create an index of all this information for every car. And in the early 90s, I took it upon myself that I was going to walk in the streets of Beirut until I encounter a car that looked exactly like one that had exploded. Whether this would take me days or hours or months, I didn't care. I needed to find the exact model all over again. And I was going to photograph every car. I would cut out the resulting photograph, place it in a notebook along with the information I had gathered. And this is the kind of information newspapers would make public. And I was going to include this information in my notebook. And I wanted to do this for every single car, 3,640 cars. I was going to find them again. Now, there's something pathological about this for sure, but I think for me it fit. This is something that my historian would easily do. And I needed the universe of this historian. I needed the universe of somebody who was focused on these displacements. Not who did the car, but what kind of brand it was. Somebody who would take this information seriously, would treat it as the hysterical symptom of an event that could not speak itself, and this is the necessary form of this event. And that these necessary forms of these events, they're not banal, they're not tangential, they are the necessary forms of the event and have to be the forms through which one goes through to write the history of these wars. I mean, the only, the one thing I could think of that's similar in American history that I experienced myself was the September 11 attacks and how those accounts of that day always begin with the weather that day and what kind of blue sky it was. So now we could say that a full account of September 11, a sociopolitical account, must certainly understand the geopolitical motives that motivated 19 men to crash these planes into this building. And this would help us understand this event. Yes, that's certainly an important dimension. But what do we do with the weather as a central element in the way that story was formulated, in the way we made sense of that event? Should somebody collect every references of what kind of blue it was that day as the form that the event must take? Is the blue of the sky a way to naturalize the event and prefigures the fall, not only of the towers, but of everything we have had to go through in the past 8 years in terms of the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan? Was the weather and the blue sky the forms of this kind of, you don't look at the buildings, or you look at the buildings, but you also look at the blue sky? It's contiguous to it, it's metaphorically linked to it, it comes to stand for it in some way. And I would think that maybe in a history of September 11 would be lacking if it did not include also these references to the blue skies, as well as the geopolitical, the economic, all these other dimensions, but also these references to the blue sky. And I can think that maybe with these cars I was working in a similar vein. Now, the investigator couldn't tell if the car was a red Celica or a blue Subaru. I had to find both cars. And then I needed the work to be formally presented this way, as if it was some kind of naive teenage formal presentation. But clearly, you could see, like, curving the text around, keeping the cat at the bottom of the Honda. These were little gestures that I kind of relished at some point. Now, doing this work opened up a very important set of questions that I had to explore with others. One of the questions, I mean, another form that this event, when I was looking at the archives, at the car bombs, I don't know if you know this, but when a car bomb explodes, the only thing that remains intact is the engine or the front end, because it's made out of a solid core of steel. And these engines would just fly. They would fly tens, sometimes hundreds of meters from the detonation and would land on a balcony, on a roof, on a street. And then the photojournalists who were covering the war started having a competition of who was going to find and photograph the engine first. So to confirm this, I had to dig through the archive to find what the pictures of engines looked like. And I found about 100 of them. And this was the front and the back of the same photograph, as I found in different newspaper archives. And the engine had a weird place in the investigation. There were photographs like this one where politicians would pose next to the engine to prove they were doing everything in their power to catch the people responsible. I mean, the engine had an engine number. The engine number would lead you to the car registration to the owner to the possible culprit. But in 99% of the cases, just like in Iraq, cars used as car bombs are usually stolen. So their owners have nothing to do with these events. But again, this was the form of the event that was disseminated publicly. It became almost like the black box in airplane crashes, as if finding the engine meant finding the story, understanding who did this and why. How could this have happened? And these engines almost became treated like body parts. I mean, the archives, I would see an engine, and then the next part might be a hand or a leg, and they became almost interchangeable. And they looked, I think this photograph was very touching for me, because it looked as if these things just landed out of nowhere, as if there's no reason. It just, there's an engine, it just popped in the middle of the of life. Why? We don't know. Should we tell you? Not really. And here it very much looks like a, you know, the oil spill is like a blood spill. Then I met this man. His name is Yusuf Bitar. He was in a lot of these pictures of car bomb engines, and decided to track him and found him. And he was the Lebanese state's chief investigator of car bomb detonations and primary kind of ammunitions expert, trained by the French in the 40s, did many tours all around the world, and throughout the Civil War was a highly respected figure who was thought to, he was the only person permitted by all the militias, he was a state official, to travel anywhere he wanted. He could go to the east part of Beirut or to the west part of Beirut, and these were divided parts, and nobody gave him trouble because he was thought to be a scientist who did not politicize his findings. And he was doing the basic work of collecting the logistical facts of these events. He's a very interesting figure because I kept seeing, he showed me his own archives and he loved the press. This is a person who, the first thing you meet him, he will show you every article that has ever been written about him. He's got a great story that he likes to tell about how he became an explosives expert. He had told it to too many reporters and you could tell. But in the past 10 years, nobody had really talked to him. So he was longing for the days when people were actively seeking him out, when militiamen wanted favors with him, and when journalists always wanted to know what he knew. And he had a very loose tongue. He liked to say, what politician tried to hire him to pretend to plant the car bomb to kill said politician so that said politician might be important in the sense that he's worthy of an assassination. And then he would, of course, be heroic because he would be the one to defuse the bomb that he had planted to begin with. He loved telling this kind of stories about corrupt politicians and what they asked him to do. And his archives included, for example, not only he had kept a copy of every investigative report he gave the state, because he never trusted the state. He thought at some point they were corrupting his findings and he needed reports that were uncorrupted, that he kept covertly in his own house. So he would show them to me. And then he collected cartoons, like cartoons about car bombs or bombs in general. Every cover of Lebanese newspaper that had to do with car bomb detonations, he collected. And then he also drew the scenes of the crime as opposed to rely simply on photographers. This is the drawing he made, for example, of the 1987 assassination of the prime minister. And I had to go look at the photographs to see, well, these are two different kinds of facts and what's their relation. And he did say he draws these things because he never trusted photographers. And that the drawings for him were somehow had a more valid juridical function. Whether that stood in court or not, I don't know. The other person I met was the photographer named George Semerjian, who had taken many of the pictures of engines I showed you earlier. Now, he has also a tragic figure because he will be killed in 1990 and he will be photographed as he lay dying. And then at his funeral, he was the representative, he was the union chief for the photojournalists in Lebanon. He was a very respected figure, and his colleagues will come to his funeral and place their cameras in on his coffin in this gesture of kind of homage and protest. But I was given access to his entire negative archive. And it fascinated me because this is the person who had photographed more car bombs than anyone else in the Lebanese wars. And looking through the archive, I realized that he had a particular approach. He would always hear the explosion and go up to an elevated perspective, like a roof, to see where the plume of smoke was coming from. I mean, he would photograph the plume of smoke. And then he would take a few pictures of the plume of smoke, and then he would drive to the scene. He'd immediately be halted by a wall of heat, like he couldn't penetrate. But as soon as the wall of heat dissipated, like it wasn't as hot, he would go through the wall of heat, past the victims, to the crater. And he would photograph the crater. And from the crater, only after he'd photographed the crater, he would start to photograph the victims. And after the victims, he would photograph the carnage. But he would draw a very distinct perimeter. Like, it's almost as if he needed the crater as the center of a radius he's going to define with his photographs. And the negatives themselves, the images of the car bomb, seemed very familiar in the sense that they appeared like caricatures or photographs of destruction. But then they, having seen enough of these, I decided with an architect named Tony Shakar and a poet artist named Bilal Khbez, he's a political commentator as well, we decided to launch a project where we would dedicate as much time as it took to study each car bomb, one car bomb at a time. And we had three motives: gather all logistical facts, gather all political facts, and study what remains of these car bombs in the present. And initially, we began with this not necessarily as an art project, but as some kind of socio-political study. And remarkably, what we thought was that, one, the logistical facts could be gathered, just nobody had done it, and we could do it. The political facts, we were also convinced, could be done. Nobody had done it. We could identify culprits and name them. Over a year and a half, by working on one car bomb, we realized that these were, in fact, the least troubling aspects of these detonations. That car bombs such as these, especially when you have 3,640 car bombs, have a way of affecting neighborhoods and cities in ways that remain intact 20 years later, or even after the threat that motivated these car bombs disappears. And that these effects on neighborhoods could only be visible sometimes through artworks. That some of these dimensions, some of these spatial and temporal shifts that had been affecting neighborhoods could be manifest to some artists, writers, thinkers, possibly others, but because I'm an artist, I thought I was able, through some artworks, to detect certain things that I then decided have to become the focus of these projects. So that what I thought was the most urgent, the logistical facts, the political and juridical facts, became over time the least important parts. And there was something much more insidious about these events than these dimensions. And then ended up producing a videotape called We Can Make Rain, But No One Came to Ask, that became the basis of this study. And the study itself was called My Neck is Thinner Than a Hair, A History of Car Bombs in the Lebanese Wars, 1975-1991, volumes 1 to 3,641. It took us almost 2 years to do volume 1, so I'm not sure how long it would take us to do 3,640 volumes. I'm not going to show this. Well, I'll just talk briefly about... I thought at some point that there had to be a competition for... a state competition for a memorial to the car bomb victims. And what if somebody got engines and cars that looked exactly like the ones that had exploded and display them, each car with its engine suspended above it 10 meters in one large space? And it turned out that somebody had produced this and had convinced Fiat to donate one car and one engine, but is hoping still to get Benz and BMW to donate cars. So far, they are unsuccessful. I want to see how I'm doing on time. Do I have another 10, 15 minutes? Okay. Maybe the last two documents I will show are, they introduce themselves. So I'll just show this one. It's a 6 or 7 minute tape, and then I'll introduce and show the last document. if we can maybe kill the lights all the way down, that would be great. Okay, I think I'm going to end now because it's just about reached an hour. And I would have shown you one more document about captivity that dealt with the Iran-Contra affair and the kidnapping of Americans in Lebanon. It's a tape called Hostage, the Bashar Tapes, but maybe for another time. Thank you. Okay. If you have some... Yes.
I wanted to ask you again, what was the name of the Walter Benjamin books that you read?
I think it's called On Some Motifs in Baudelaire. And it's in the Illuminations book. Yes.
The piece that's in the MoMA, where it's, oh God, you said to bring two trees, the digital prints. Did you choose, you know, the size of the explosion rooms, like specifically so you draw the viewer to explore the piece as a whole more?
You mean the size of the clouds, the plumes?
Yeah, the size of the actual print.
Yeah.
Yeah, is it to invite the viewer to almost like document it themselves? Because that's how I saw it.
Yeah. That piece includes, you know, about 30 maybe plumes of smoke. The interesting thing about that piece is that in the caption, these are all these detonations were from the Israeli bombings of Lebanon, mostly from 2006. And there was an essay that accompanied the piece. It's the last plate, in which I tried to describe how these events felt, having gone through the 82 invasion and then living the 2006 invasion yet again. And how odd it felt to have to listen to, on the one hand, Hezbollah's discourse, and on the other hand, Olmert and Livni, and then Bush and Condoleezza Rice, and being unable to identify with any kind of position from... but the remarkable thing at MoMA is that that they decided to not put that these are Israeli detonations. They just said, I'm exploring war in the abstract. Which, yes, I'm not exploring war in the abstract. These were particular detonations from a particular war, and I thought I wanted it very clear. Now, maybe this was... I had mentioned it to the curators, and they promised to rectify the situation, and I hope they have. But the last time I saw it hadn't been rectified. And I don't know what yet this is about. I can't tell whether it's better to speak about these wars in the abstract, and maybe in that context, it's the only way to speak about it, as opposed to address, because they did publish the essay where I name very specifically the players involved, whether it's Hezbollah or the Lebanese state or the Egyptians or the Saudis or the Americans and the Israelis. So it's unsure. But in that piece, I really wanted the plumes to feel like stains at the same time. And I couldn't tell if they were stains on the paper or they were cut out or coming through, whether it was they reference actual detonations or somehow they had become so abstracted and formalized that it was very difficult to see what they referenced to begin with. Yes.
I wondered if you identified with the mythical Atlas, and if you do, if you could, expand on that.
You know, I really did not. I am sure I do, but I never... the only thing I did is just look up the definition and I never kind of used it. And I'm hoping that it's not that it, I don't know why it hasn't interested me per se. And I'm not sure where, I'm trying to think of where I had come up with the Atlas Group definition. And I was thinking at some point of actually Gerhard Richter's Atlas project, more so than the mythological figure. But maybe, I don't know if it's apt or not, or you can tell me. I don't know much more than just the definition.
Well, I mean, it's just, you know, Atlas is the strong man who had to hold up the earth on his shoulder.
Yeah, that's as far as I got as well. But I didn't understand, you know, why did Atlas have to carry the world on his shoulder? Is it apt to think about violence and the Atlas in this way? I never kind of explored that further. I just like this idea of carrying the weight, and that's about it. Yes.
Could you perhaps comment a little bit about the reception of your work and your presentations? I'm sure in Beirut it is received in a very different way, as it is perhaps in New York or here. So could you tell us a little bit about that, perhaps? And the second question, if I may, is, so has the Atlas project kind of helped you make a different sense of the war in Beirut? Has it had a more mundane aim behind it, or was it just more of an aesthetic exercise?
In terms of the reception in Beirut, I've only presented it in lecture form, mainly. And I never wanted to exhibit the plates. Different projects, I think, were received differently. The project on the history of the car bomb, My Neck is Thinner Than a Hair, where we studied one car bomb, that was premiered in Beirut. And it was a very interesting reception to that project, because we tried arbitrarily to pick the car we were studying. It's a car that exploded in East Beirut in 1986. And we presented the project, we presented the logistical facts, and we named culprits. And then we proceeded to examine the consequences of these cars on today's Beirut. But it also did not have only to do with Beirut. It seemed to me to be as much about New York, Bali, Madrid, and Beirut, or lessons from Beirut at the same time. But the reception in Beirut then was strange. Well, it wasn't strange. We had, in a way, we could have expected it, but we didn't. Why did we start with a car that killed Christians? Why didn't we start with a car that killed Druze or Muslims or Shia? And in a way, we knew something like this could come up, and we had kind of two possible answers. One, this is volume one of 3,641. We promised the next one will be about. But that was, of course, we knew that was never going to satisfy anyone. It seemed as if the only place you could begin to tell this story is to say that somebody dear to me died in this bomb. And that seemed to like clear some room for you to speak if you invoke this statement. Now, nobody dear to me died in this bomb, but somebody dear to somebody died in this bomb. But the fact that you had to invoke this to permit a space to speak became equally interesting for us, that you have to invoke death, you have to invoke mourning, it has to come from the eye to be able to write this story, not another. Because the idea of an ongoing historical project was not going to matter. Now different documents were received differently. It's not, I don't think it's, maybe to your last part of your question, I'm not sure what you mean when you say it's an aesthetic exercise, but today...
I'm sorry, I mean, it's kind of simplistic question, maybe, out of curiosity, is, was there another aim? I mean, what was specifically the goal of this project on a personal level, or even with your colleagues that worked with you at the Atlas Group? And other Lebanese artists are sort of documenting the war in different ways as well. I can recall, you know, several artists' works, but I've always wondered, you know, what was the sort of, you know, sort of the aim behind it, particularly as, for instance, now I see a number of Iraqi artists kind of going down that line as well. And so, you know, it's really kind of a, maybe not a very smart question, but
no,
just, you know,
it's,
simple.
It's real.
You know, what did you have another aim behind that? Was there a personal, perhaps, need to understand the war in a different way through the specific sort of, you know, events that you, I mean, there is an aesthetic aspect to all of this as well.
Well, you know, initially it was, initially it was pretty much this idea of having read all these historical narratives and the psychobiography of the participants and feeling very dissatisfied with the fact that these do not exhaust my experience of these events. And there was something left unanswered by these chronological histories or the reading, the motivations behind the various players. And then I think these things are always a strange combination of personal, formal, political, social, economic. But at some point, this idea of... at some point, the psychoanalytic model of trauma started to ring true, that there were certain things that were lived but not experienced, and they had produced these hysterical traces that I needed to collect. Now, and that was current, I think, with a lot of people working at the time in Beirut. They started to think about the war in this way, that there were some elements that had that remained in culture that had not been examined, and somebody needed to do so. Now, that for me has been, and for a lot of other artists, has been rethought today. Like, we're trying to wonder, why did we have to think about this history through the history of the war, through a model of trauma that was necessarily psychological? Were there other dimensions that we were blind to that we did not examine? And I think that's becoming more and more true today. For example, the Atlas Group for me ends in 2004. It's a project that I say began in 89 and ended 2004. Even if I produce an object today that follows the same logic, I need to place it back in that period. I will date it to 2001 or 1987 or 1986 if it follows the same kind of laws of that project. But today, for example, to be involved in an aesthetic, I look at these today as aesthetic facts, right? So I think, in a way, there are different kinds of facts, and I need facts. I don't, just because I'm working in fiction does not mean the opposite of that is nonfiction. Some things may manifest themselves only in fiction and nowhere else. And fiction is the place that permits them to emerge. So that fiction is not the opposite of nonfiction, and aesthetics is not on one end and history is on the other of some kind of epistemic spectrum. As somebody who needs facts, I understand that I need social facts, I need political facts, I need historical facts, but I also need aesthetic facts. And the interesting thing about the artists I look at is that they tend to treat these things on a continuum. The socio-political, cultural, economic, aesthetic fact, there exists for them on a continuum. So there's no necessary kind of rupture from moving from one to the other. And one is defined by the other, which I've always found fascinating in how some artists can do this. Now, I'm not sure if these works do this, but I realize today that, oh, okay, there is such a thing as an aesthetic fact, and in fact, an aesthetic fact makes demands, and you stand in front of a painting or video or sculpture. It's a fact. Somebody did it. Yes, and then good.
So, you sort of prefaced the presentation you gave tonight talking about the texts that you read and talking about, and you just re talked about looking at these things through the psychoanalytic model of trauma. And then, and while you were talking about that, I was thinking about a writer that I'm wondering if you have read, Rafa Ettinger. Do you know her work? She's a psychoanalyst and a painter who talks a lot about trauma. And so then, you said that you had sort of felt like maybe you had exhausted that model or were trying to move outside of that model. And maybe you did address that again through the talk, but I didn't I kind of wanted you to really touch on that kind of as an idea. And the thing that for me is coming up in my mind is the story that you were talking about, and I'm not going to get the specifics correct maybe, but the idea that these events, the more insidious or the most significant thing that happened, was about how they affected neighborhoods, these spaces 20 years later. And somehow that seemed to me, And you said the idea about the horses and the idea of too early, too late, and could the horse freeze, you talk about. So maybe you can address that.
Yeah. Can it be a wordy answer? Is it? It's a long answer. In neighborhoods that had, for example, I live in New York today, and I have no clue who my neighbors are, and I like not knowing who my neighbors are. Not because they are not nice. I like the anonymity that life in a city can afford. I like going up to my house and doing my thing, and sometimes I'm surprised that people cross each other in the hallway. We don't even say hello. Okay. In Beirut, at a certain point, if you lived in a building and a car bomb was detonating every day, at some point you needed to know who was your neighbor, because you needed to know not only who was your neighbor, you need to know if your neighbor had a car, if their daughter or son were dating somebody who drove a car. What kind of car was it, and is it parked in front of my house? Why? Because you know that these car bombs are detonating all the time. The state is not able to secure the area. The militias are not able to secure the area. You realize that a particular logic develops. One of the logic is that you start asking your neighbors to reveal their secrets in the absence of a crime they've committed. Not unlike going to the subway in Manhattan today, and there's signs that say, your backpack may be searched at any moment, just be advised. And at some point right after September 11, you had people who started wearing backpacks that were made of clear plastic, right? So this public-private distinction is one of the first consequences of these repeated assaults, so much so that one could say people now are going into the subway and they haven't committed a crime, and the police usually needs a reason to invade your private realm. And now you go into the subway and consistently confess your innocence because you're wearing a backpack that is clear. You're showing, I'm not a terrorist. Now that's one September 11. With 3,640 September 11, a different kind of logic is going to develop following that line of the plastic backpack, where it's not just backpacks that will be transparent, but walls will be transparent. So you will literally be able to see through the wall to your neighbor's house to know he or she is dating somebody who he or she... But you don't do this. This logic develops not for the entire city. It develops in a very small perimeter. Inside this perimeter, everything needs to be transparent. Outside of it, everything is foreign. And you always realize too late that you've crossed the threshold of that limit. And these limits remain intact 30, 40 years after the threat of car bombs has disappeared. So that people inside these things can only trust now the neighbor or the person on stage, and they absolutely will not trust the local militia, certainly not the state. So after a war, a state can come and say, we're going to rebuild roads, we're going to rehabilitate facades, we're going to provide services. One of the things they fail to notice is that this logic, for example, of space, has remained intact, and what you need to do is rebuild time as chronological and space as homogeneous. This is not a ghetto with its own logic. This is a part of the city like any other. Please open it up. Please dissolve this notion of time and space you've developed in here. This is on space in terms of the transparency. In terms of time, you know that a car bomb exploded yesterday. You know that one will explode today. You know one will explode tomorrow. You have no clue. You cannot make plans for something that's going to happen tomorrow or next week because you don't even think you're going to survive. You know you survived yesterday's. You think you might survive this one, but you certainly don't know if you're going to survive tomorrow's. So time becomes very fragmented. You constantly find yourself living in the present, unable to make long-term plans. Now, the cornerstones of a particular, a citizenship might mean that you don't think that you live in a ghetto that's distinct from any other ghetto. You might think that you live in a city where the notion of time and space operating in your neighborhood is similar to the one operating elsewhere. You have to believe that in order to believe that you're equal rights under the law, and part of that equality is you share the same notion of time and space. And this is the one thing that I think in terms of the state, they have difficulty dealing with. Now, who can see this logic? Having spent 3 years documenting this one neighborhood, at some point I thought I was going nuts. Because you would photograph storefronts that are open. In the photographs, they would appear closed. You think that you're videotaping people that are there. In the artwork, they appear disappearing. Now, I'm not saying this if I see this as a person, I need psychological help, or I've taken some bad drugs, right? If I say storefronts are open or closed. In an artwork, they appear as such, right? And you say that the artwork is showing me something that I, as a person, they're not available to me as a person. Now, Jalal had a formulation to think this that was fascinating for me. He says, in such instances, art functions like the mirror in vampire films. It reveals the withdrawal of that which you think is still there. So the idea is that a vampire, it's not that they don't have a reflection. You know, you're a vampire, I'm human, we're looking in a mirror. Vampire has no reflection is because the vampire doesn't have one? No, the reflection takes a very long time to come back. Right? So there is a reflection, but because the vampire exists in a different time, the time is very... If a vampire says to you, I haven't seen you in a long time, they don't mean yesterday. They mean centuries. And they literally mean this. And that logic is solid across vampiric literature. So the mirror has a reflection, except that because the vampire lives in a different time, you're going to have to wait centuries to get that reflection back. So there is a reflection. So an artwork can function like this sometimes, right? But you become sensitive to something that is not yet there. But you don't know why you're sensitive to it. You just feel it. You intuit its presence. And you try to document it. But the documentation of that nothing is very difficult. The most sharp example of this in film might be somebody like Alain René's opening in Hiroshima Mon Amour, where this French woman gone to Hiroshima to see the carnage produced by the nuclear disaster. And she's sitting in bed with her Japanese lover, and he constantly keeps telling her, you have seen nothing in Hiroshima. And this is written by Marguerite Duras, who's a very good writer. If she wanted to say, you have seen little in Hiroshima, she would have written, you have seen little. She said, you have seen nothing in Hiroshima. And the French woman says, but I've gone to the museums. I've seen the traces of the war. And the Japanese man tells her, no. You have seen nothing. So the Japanese man seems to be insistent that in certain instances, it is better and more ethical to say that you have seen nothing than to say that you have seen something. So it's better to say that I'm looking in the mirror and I intuit the presence of a nothing, because yet I haven't produced the space-time to make that available reflection come back to me, than to say, yes, I can see the carnage, it's in museums and what have you. That's the more ethical response Duras is proposing. And that I found, I have an affinity today with that idea. Not an affinity that's conceptual. I feel that in certain neighborhoods, I felt this relationship in an artwork, not as a person. In an artwork, some things become, and you don't trust it. This happens in an artwork, I say, I don't trust it, I need confirmation. I'll go to another artist I trust. If they confirm it to me, great. And I need one confirmation, and I found it. If I find one confirmation that says, this is the logic in this place, I'm going to trust it. But then you're very alone sometimes, because you think you're having hallucinations or... I know this sounds a little wacky, but it's okay.
Would you say that your work is a kind of reflection then of the unseen, kind of like what you know, you reference in a vampire is how you can't see them in the reflection. You can see yourself. It's like almost you're allowing us to see through your work and archiving things that, you know, people in Beirut would people outside of Beirut are not involved at all. Like me myself as an individual would never have known or had that human attachment. Like all I have access to is, you know, the media that has been fed to me, of course, the ocean, Britain, or in the States.
No, I'm not sure if any of the work that I've done so far has done this. I think the things I'm trying to work on now, like I can't tell if this is true. But the formulation I'm using is to provide in a non-available form something like about this condition. To provide, but in a non-available form. Is it about visibility? Sometimes. Is it about the availability to vision? Maybe. Is it about availability in another form? I can't tell. So I haven't yet figured out what is the proper way to speak this. I mean, the language of trauma provides one way to speak it, right? Like you have this hole in the middle of the psyche that manifests itself through this itch that you have in the side of your face. That's the form of the event. And the psychoanalytic treatment is not meant to, it's meant to make sure the itch isn't there, to return you to the cause of that event. That's the story Freud tells us about the psychoanalytic situation. But it's never a return, right? It's the production of a story that rings true in the present for the future that has very little to do with the past, and it's very much about fantasy. So the nature of the whole of that absence, even in the psychoanalytic literature, is very interesting. It's a fantasy. It's not even a personal fantasy. It's based on collective memories. It's not even your own memory. And it has less to do with what happened in the past, but very much to do with what you do in the present for the future. Right? That's a very different model from the model of you sit on the couch, you go back to the way the event happened. As soon as you remember it, the symptom goes away. That's not it. I mean, it seems more interesting, I think, in the way Freud tells us that story. Now, the nature of this whole here, I don't know what it is. I haven't yet figured out what the language is. Maybe, yes, one last one.
You mentioned that you needed facts, and I found it interesting your color-coded bullets, the ammunition that you had, and sort of the way the American media spins arms stealing, like we're not a part of it at all, and I found it interesting that you had the documentation to prove that, you know, all these other nations are feeding the fire, so to speak. Was there ever multiple rounds coming from the same supplier, two different militias?
Yeah, I mean, I made it kind of clean and neat in my plates, but, you know, the same militia would get weapons from the Soviet Union, from Yugoslavia, from China, from secondary dealers, and from Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. They were, surely, I mean, it's just about cost. Okay, I think we will end now. Thank you very much.